On the feature interview today, Dr. Ross McKittrick. He's an economist who specializes in the economic impacts of government policies regarding climate change.
Everybody on all sides of the debate, no matter which model they're using, everyone would agree that those policies have absolutely no effect on the climate. The amount of emission changes up or down are so minuscule that they don't even show up in a model. So if climate change is costly and you implement all these policies, you still get the same climate change. You just also paid for all these policies that didn't actually have any effect on the problem.
In the news portion, a number of pro-life MPs are getting set to retire. We talked to We Need a Law's Mike Schutin about what that might mean for the pro-life cause on the federal scene. Some more follow-up on the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Ontario's public input on the conscience rights of doctors, Canadian Medical Association's weighing in on euthanasia, and we take a look ahead to the annual ARPA National Tour that kicks off in Ottawa later this fall.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
How important is it for the pro-life cause to have MPs sitting on the Hill in Ottawa? That question may seem somewhat simplistic. After all, those MPs would be considered the pro-life movement's pipeline into the halls of power. But the question is taking on an increased sense of urgency, and the answer may not be all that it seems. The Globe and Mail did a piece late last month talking about the number of conservative MPs who've already announced they won't be running in next year's election. There's quite a few of them, 18 so far, and some of the names are pretty well known in the pro-life community. Russ Hebert, Diana Blonsey, Brian Storseth, and LeVar Payne among them. We Need a Law's Mike Schutin says one departure will definitely hurt.
We're going to miss Maurice Vallicott. I mean, undoubtedly, he's been one of the most ardent voices in Ottawa in regards to the life issue, whether it's on the euthanasia side or on the side that we're working on the side of pre-born human rights. So definitely we're going to miss him.
As for the others, though, Mike says that, surprisingly, the impact might not really be that great.
I guess my question is, what have we seen from these pro-life MPs? Aside from the odd time when a motion or a bill comes forward and they certainly vote in favor of that, and it's always a positive development, they haven't necessarily championed our cause. They're solid men and women. But it really, I think what it does is it speaks to the need for a campaign like ours. Because we know, when speaking with men and women in Ottawa or at the provincial level in legislatures, that there are many of them that are on our side when it comes to restrictions on abortion, protection for children before birth. But they're unwilling to do anything to go out on a limb, so to speak, until they know that public sentiment is strong enough that it will not be a risk to them should they start promoting these issues.
This whole issue also prompted an op-ed piece in the Hill Times. Andrew Cardozo, who's an adjunct professor at Carleton University, wrote that with Justin Trudeau's edict that pro-lifers need not apply for candidacy in the Liberal Party, along with the NDP's identical position, and Stephen Harper's long-standing edict that the abortion issue will not be allowed to come to a vote in Parliament, pro-life Canadians are not being left with a lot of options, except, perhaps, for the Christian Heritage Party. But Schutin says it's unclear whether the CHP will be able to capitalize on the growing vacuum.
I'm not sure that they can gain a foothold because of this. I think they're probably having discussions as to how they would go forward. But it does, as the Hill Times reported, does provide an opportunity for them to really push themselves as a pro-life party. And if you're a pro-life Canadian, we want to give you that opportunity to vote for a pro-life candidate. I think historically they've had maybe 50 to 70 candidates. Of the 308, now 338, so the challenge for them is to have candidates in ridings for pro-life Canadians to actually vote for.
The next federal election, by the way, is scheduled for October 19th of next year. Last month, you'll recall we featured an interview in the program with lawyer Albertos Palizagopoulos on a public consultation that was held in Ontario over the so-called conscience rights of doctors. Should they, for example, be allowed to refuse to prescribe birth control pills or be allowed to refuse to perform abortions based on their conscience? The results of that consultation process are in now, and they are overwhelmingly in favor of preserving those conscience rights. Part of the process involved an online survey which asked the question whether doctors should be allowed to refuse to provide a patient with a treatment or procedure because it conflicts with the physician's religious or moral beliefs. Almost 33,000 people responded to that poll. 77% of them voted yes. The Abortion Rights Coalition isn't particularly pleased or impressed with those results. They wrote on their Facebook page at the end of August that, quote, "The anti-choice movement has been spamming the consultation process." No word yet on when the college will respond to the latest round of consultation or when they'll be unveiling any possible changes in their conscience rights policy. Speaking of doctors, the Canadian Medical Association is weighing in on the euthanasia question. The association's general counsel voted 91% in favor last month of a subtle shift in their position, a motion that would allow physicians to follow their conscience in deciding to provide or withhold euthanasia to a patient within the bounds of legislation. Alex Schadenberg with the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition says this is the CMA's way of trying to navigate itself into a neutral position on euthanasia. Right now, the group is officially against the practice. He says the doctors group is getting ready to adapt its policies to fit the legal landscape if that changes. All of that hinges on the outcome of the so-called Carter case, which is before the Supreme Court now. ARPA, incidentally, has been invited to present arguments to the court on that case. But for now, the newly elected president of the CMA, Dr. Chris Simpson, says euthanasia must not be seen, quote, as a first or second or even third choice, but a choice that's appropriate for people after all other reasonable options are exhausted. It's September, and that means ARPA is getting ready to do their annual national tour. The person who coordinates the tour is our office gal, Nikki Devereaux. And Nikki, what are we doing this year? Where are we going? Who's on tour?
Mark Penninga, our executive director. We're going to have Andre Schutten, who is the Ontario director and legal counsel for ARPA Canada, and Bruce DeBoer as well. He is our grassroots coordinator. So what we're doing is we're coming to a bunch of cities across Ontario, Alberta, and southern BC, and we're going to be talking about a number of different issues. So we're looking at, do Christian Canadians really have 2020 vision? We're focusing on three topics. The first one is religious freedom. We're going to be looking at the Trinity Western University court cases. Then we're going to be looking at euthanasia, the Supreme Court intervention we have in the case of Carter versus Canada. And also Bruce is going to be walking us through how everybody can get involved, be a salt and light in their day-to-day lives in practical ways.
Last year's tour got pretty good crowds up because of the Loyola case. Are we expecting similar kinds of interest this time around?
Well, we certainly hope so. We've seen a lot of issues that have come up in the last year. Our prostitution law was struck down last December. Now Quebec has actually legalized euthanasia, and now we have a case before the Supreme Court. And I think a lot of people are really becoming more aware of what these issues are and are no longer thinking that this is just out there. Especially with Loyola, we saw how this is going to impact not just the public school system, but also the Christian schools. So I think a lot of people have really bought in to the importance of getting involved, being engaged with political work. And so we have people for all ages, and we really encourage our churches and our pastors to encourage the younger folk, but also we've got moms and dads and grandparents and young adults. There really is no age restriction, and the feedback that we've received from people has been really, really positive. So we've seen a lot of people getting more involved after things like a fall tour.
Do you have the list sitting in front of you in terms of the dates and places they're going to be? And if so, could you run it down for me?
Yeah, absolutely. Wednesday, October 15th, we're going to kick off at Jubilee Church in Ottawa. Then we're going to head down to Burlington a couple weeks later. That's going to be October 28th. The Wednesday, we're going to be in Woodstock. Thursday, October 30th, we're going up to Fergus. On the Friday, we're going to be in Owen Sound. The guys will take a break over the weekend. Monday, November 3rd, they're going to be back in the Burlington area. They're going to go to Coketown at Rehoboth School. Tuesday, they're going to head up to Nobleton, just north of Toronto. Wednesday, they're going to be in Bowmanville. Thursday, they're going to head out to Chatham. And then Friday, they're going to wrap up the Ontario portion at Heritage Christian School in Jordan. Then they're going to take a couple weeks off. And Monday, November 17th, they kick off the Alberta leg. And they're going to start in Edmonton. They're going to head south to Pinoca. They're going to go back north to Barrhead for Wednesday, November 19th. Then they're going to go to Grand Prairie on November 20th and wrap up Friday, November 21st in Calgary. And then in early 2015, we're going to hit up southern BC with a couple dates as well.
Okay. Thank you, Nikki.
You're welcome.
And we're back with the interview portion of the program. On the telephone with me today is Dr. Ross McKittrick. He's an economics professor, chair of graduate studies at the Department of Economics and Finance at the University of Guelph. Dr. McKittrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Can we start, first of all, just talking a little bit about who you are and sort of your credentials, if you will. You're an economist. You're not a climatologist, but this interview is going to focus primarily on some new research you've done with respect to the whole question of climate change. What do you bring to that discussion?
Well, I began working on this many years ago as an economist looking at climate policy. And on the physical science side, a lot of the questions that now are being looked at are actually statistical questions. They're questions that involve application of a branch of statistics called time series analysis. And that's an area where economists have been heavily involved over the years developing the techniques and using them. And there are now quite a few economists and econometricians, as they're called, or applied statisticians, working on these physical science questions because we have the techniques that are necessary for asking these questions. So the kind of work that you mentioned that I've recently done, it's not atmospheric science or meteorology or anything. It's really applied statistical analysis of the kind that's very common in economics journals, but we can apply them to the climate data sets to start answering some of the questions that are being asked about those.
Okay, you're a well-known skeptic on the question of climate change, if we can use that term. Let's get one shibboleth out of the way right off the top. You're not funded by big oil, right?
No. The funding that I get is from my university for the most part, and through a fellowship from my college, and then also from the Institute for New Economic Thinking. I have a grant from them for studying carbon taxes. And this idea that skeptics are out there being funded by big oil, it's never been true. And all I can say is if people hear that, they should ask for specific examples and specific amounts. There's an awful lot of money at stake in the global warming debate, but that money is on the side of large environmental groups and renewable energy firms and groups like that that are putting a lot of money into promoting a policy agenda. The kind of work that I do gets very little funding from any source, and in any case, none of it comes from the energy sector.
A brief description, if you will, of sort of the philosophical underpinnings of the way you do your work. I mean, you know, I know you're known for looking at environmental stewardship as a cause in itself, but a lot of the science that seems to be out there right now, and you've already alluded to it, seems to be driven by an agenda of a preconceived outcome. That's not the way you approach this, right?
Well, the work that I do is data-driven. I tend to begin by looking at the kinds of questions that people are asking, and I think about, well, how do you measure it, and what are the data sets? An example of that is a website I created not long ago called yourenvironment.ca. When I hear discussions about air pollution trends or water pollution trends or things like that, I know that all of those things are measured. We have a huge amount of air pollution data in Canada and water pollution data, but very little of it is made accessible to the public. So I created yourenvironment.ca so that anyone could go and look up the air pollution records for the community in which they live. And a lot of these records go back to the 1970s. Because I think we should have these discussions, but they should be based on everybody seeing the measurements, everybody seeing what the data show. Similarly, with climate data, a lot of discussions take place and people actually don't realize this stuff is measured, or if it is measured, what the measurements show. And so the work that I do always begins with what the data look like, first of all. And then when you do that, actually you get into very narrow and more obscure points of disagreement. So in that sense, I don't think pigeonholing someone as a skeptic or an alarmist or whatever usually comes down to whether they trust the data more or the climate models more. And I'm definitely a data guy.
Okay, we'll talk about the data. We've had, depending on who you talk to, 18 or 19 years of no warming in terms of the average temperature. At least that's some of the data I've seen from various places. And people will be shocked to hear that because, you know, we're all assuming that the temperature is getting warmer. here in BC, we're going through a drought right now. I know in Ontario, you haven't had a particularly warm summer, but, you know, we keep hearing about more storms, and you've done some research that would seem to indicate that, in fact, things are not getting worse.
Well, on the local front, when you hear about, say, communities in BC, are they getting warmer? There, I would say, okay, go to yourenvironment.ca, look on the air temperatures section, just look up your page, you can get the temperature records back to the year 1900 and see for yourself what it looks like. And again, I think people might be kind of surprised what the picture looks like, because they hear one thing and nobody ever shows them the data. On the global scale, it's actually been widely discussed, and in the most recent report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they did acknowledge there's been a hiatus for about 15 years in the globally averaged temperature records. But there was a lot of guesswork around, well, how long is that hiatus? So the paper that I published just presents a fairly precise statistical definition of what a trendless data series would look like and how long is that portion of the data set. And the numbers show it's 19 years now at the surface, and then between 16 and 26 years in the lower troposphere. That's just a statistical definition, though, of how long we've gone without an upward trend or a significant upward trend in temperatures at the global scale. So 19 years, of course, that means that the folks in university now, they grew up hearing about global warming, but they haven't actually experienced it. It was in the decades prior to that. The surprise is that the past 20 years or so, there's been a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, and greenhouse gas levels have gone up in the atmosphere. And this is what they talked about in the IPCC report. The models said we should have actually had a lot of warming, and we haven't seen it. And so the bigger question going on here is, at what point do we start to ask whether the models are just configured incorrectly?
But the IPCC claims that the heat's being hidden in the oceans. They say they're still 99% sure that the carbon emissions are the cause of the warming and that it's going to continue. I mean, Pachuri, the head of the IPCC, has said that statistically the 15-year pause that they identify really means nothing. It's got to be extended for at least another 30 years before it means anything. Is that a legitimate position?
Well, first of all, the IPCC report didn't take a position on the cause of this hiatus. They outlined a few possibilities, one of which is the models are just too sensitive to greenhouse gases, and another one, as you mentioned, maybe the oceans are just drawing the heat down to the bottom and storing it there. And there are dozens of explanations now. The one recent count, they're up to about 39 explanations that have been proposed in the literature. And all that really means is that we've been hearing for 20 years that the science has settled. Well, all of a sudden now they're saying, well, actually, we have a whole lot to figure out still about major mechanisms in the climate that affect temperatures at the global scale. So the science is far from settled. It's quite unsatisfactory, though, for someone like Pachauri to say our hypothesis won't be rejected unless there's a pause for 30 or 40 years, because in the meantime, they want to insist on this policy agenda that assumes that their hypothesis is correct. If they really think it's going to take 30 or 40 years to decide if their hypothesis is correct or not, then we should wait 30 or 40 years before we incur all the costs that would be associated with their hypothesis being correct. They can't play it both ways and say, just take us on our word, but it's actually going to be 30 years before we even know whether we're right. And again, if they've been saying all this time the science has settled and we're 99% confident in our model, then they can't turn around and say, oh, but on the other hand, we'll need to wait 30 years to decide if we're actually right. That's the opposite of being 99% confident in their model.
Let's look at some of those government policies. I mean, the EPA down in the States has got a big mat on for coal right now. They're trying to get rid of that. Here in BC, we have a carbon tax. Municipalities here are mandated on punishment of losing government grants to reduce their carbon output, all in the interest of essentially bringing the temperature down, or at least stopping the temperature increase. I like to say, you know, we're the first generation in the history of human civilization to have the arrogance to believe we can control climate, because ultimately that's what these policies are trying to do. Are these things ultimately going to do any good in terms of reducing the rate of increase in temperatures, assuming there even is an increase?
Well, that's a very simple question to answer, because everybody on all sides of the debate, no matter which model they're using, everyone would agree that those policies have absolutely no effect on the climate. The amount of emission changes up or down are so minuscule that they don't even show up in a model. So if climate change is costly for BC and you implement all these policies, you still get the same climate change. You just also paid for all these policies that didn't actually have any effect on the problem. So right off the top, you can say whatever the motivation for the policy is, it doesn't have any effect on the climate situation. It's just really costly, symbolic gestures that don't make sense on economic grounds, and you can say that regardless of whose view of the science you start with.
I was at a presentation given by Andrew Weaver not that long ago. I'm sure you know him. He's from UVic. He's now a Green Party member of the legislature here in BC. He likes to close his presentations with a cartoon that I suspect you've seen. It's been making the rounds on the internet for quite a while. I need to describe it just so that folks get a picture. It's a picture of a university lecture hall, and there's a PowerPoint frame up on the screen, and there's a list of things there. It says energy independence, preserving rainforests, sustainability, green jobs, livable cities, clean air and water, healthy children. And somebody in the audience is standing up and saying, what if it's all a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing? The inference is that, you know, reducing our carbon emissions is a good thing, irrespective of whether it has any impact on climate. I guess the question that I have is doing a lot of these things that we're doing a net positive or a net negative in terms of the economy and the environment? I mean, Cal Beisner has done some excellent work with respect to the third world, particularly Africa. 3 million women and children die there every year because of respiratory problems caused by indoor cooking fires. And he says that's because the green folks insist they shouldn't have electricity there because that would be bad for the environment. What's the balance here?
Well, with respect to that cartoon, it's a misleading message because a lot of the things on that list were things that countries have been doing already and have absolutely nothing to do with the climate change agenda. You have rainforest preservation, that's dealing with biodiversity and forest cover, and air pollution and water pollution. Those are regulated under completely separate regimes and have been for decades. And they have nothing to do with climate policy. The problem with climate policy is it's focused on carbon dioxide, which ordinarily wouldn't be thought of as an air pollutant. And it's extremely expensive and difficult to reduce CO2 emissions, and it inevitably involves cutting into energy availability to do it. And you have to do it on a huge scale to make a difference on the climate scale. So it's never going to be an outcome that if we aggressively pursue a climate agenda, we'll make a better world, even if the global warming thing turned out to be a total hoax. If global warming due to greenhouse gas emissions is not a big, big problem, the policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions don't make economic sense, and there's no way around that. You mentioned the third world situation. There was a case of a large power plant being built in South Africa, the Medupi coal-fired power plant. It was going to bring electricity to a huge region of Southern Africa that, as you say, desperately needs it to, among other things, improve the indoor and outdoor environment so they stop burning twigs and dung and coal and so on and begin to get indoor electricity and proper appliances. And it was environmental groups that fought that project bitterly, and even the government of the UK, when they were more strongly influenced by environmental groups, they tried to block the financing for that. And I just think that is an example of people completely losing the right perspective on this. That's a power plant that's going to improve the lives of millions and millions of people, and it will improve the environment, but using coal, releasing CO2. And that, to me, is an acceptable trade-off, given all the kinds of benefits that would come out of it. Fortunately, the project did get financing in the end, and it's being built, and I think it'll be a huge net benefit to the region. But these are the kinds of questions that people are going to discuss it and have a sensible discussion. It has to begin with everybody seeing what the data shows and just sort of moving past the slogans and rhetoric and actually getting down to some factual discussions. And I hope that the kind of work that I do contributes to getting the data on the table for people.
Dr. McKittrick, we're out of time. Thank you very much for this.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking.
All right. Bye-bye.
This has been Lighthouse News, shining the light of biblical truth on today's current events. Production Manager, Mark Penninga. Technical Director, Nate Bosher. Questions or feedback, email info@arpacandidate.ca. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks for another edition of Lighthouse News.